It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law, and the right advice at the right time. And Cecil and Wes are in the studio. Hi, guys.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
What are we talking about today?
Ben, the last couple of weeks we've been talking about some of the issues in and around our elder law practice. This is a practice that concerns assisting people even with very simple things, such as their powers of attorney, their health care power of attorney,
right.
their HIPAA release, anything and everything that we need for our loved one to kind of assist in these years when we get older and we need a bit of assistance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that we've talked about the last couple of weeks, of course, is protecting some assets so that if for some reason our loved one has to go into a skilled care facility, these assets we don't see in the last, say, 2 years of our life after an entire life of saving,
mm-hmm.
an entire life of having a home place that's paid for, we see all of a sudden liens placed on it as a result of a skilled care situation. Ben, one of the things we need to talk about is just kind of what that means. There's a lot of language here about skilled care. The only way that Medicaid is going to pay for assistance almost always is in a skilled care setting,
mm-hmm.
not in an assisted living setting. And we need to make sure that our listeners understand that. Now, if we are in an assisted living situation, which is most times private pay,
mm-hmm.
assisted living, then it doesn't mean that we don't need to look ahead because the time might come
right.
when we're going to transition from assisted living to skilled care.
And maybe within the same facility.
And maybe even within the same facility. But I don't think that that's something in the last couple of weeks that we've talked about that we maybe needed to go back and kind of clear up a bit. Medicaid will not pay for our care in an assisted living environment. We must be certified by our physician by a form known as an FL2. And on that FL2, there is, in fact, a block, if you will, or a provision that says that this particular patient is in need of a skilled nursing facility. And the doctor must certify that in her or his opinion that our loved one is, in fact, at a posture in their life
mm-hmm.
where they are needing the care that a skilled nursing facility would provide. It is at that point, then, that Medicaid will, in fact, pay for that skilled nursing facility if we, of course, have our ducks in a row.
Right. Okay. So, but to qualify for that is that long history that we've talked about of spend downs and the qualifications, et cetera.
Right. A lot of times, Ben, you know, the issue that Cecil just mentioned, you know, doesn't get much attention
mm-hmm.
because, you know, we're more concerned about preserving our assets as opposed to actual eligibility. But really the first threshold question is, do you need the skilled level of care?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, what we see with regard to that is sometimes it's a pretty close call. Sometimes, you know, the patient, the client is needing, you know, maybe assisted living level
right.
of care, but maybe pouring over a little bit, stepping over into the skilled nursing care, and really ultimately it comes down to, you know, the determination of the physician after the evaluation is done so that that proper FL2 is filled out. But when, you know, we talk on the program about protecting the home place and protecting the savings and
mm-hmm.
maybe the ownership interest we have in the family property and these different things that
mm-hmm.
we talk about, we're talking about a certain section, a certain subset of Medicaid law,
right.
of the Medicaid code that allows for coverage of this long-term care expense. But what Cecil is indicating is that that does not apply to the assisted living, which is a lower level of care, but it only applies to the skilled care
mm-hmm.
Situation.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes even, you know, we see this, which I think is just a problem in the law and the way that the Medicaid rules and Medicaid rules are written, is sometimes I think that the physician feels somewhat compelled because of the totality of the circumstances to indicate that the person needs to go to skilled nursing
right.
facility. And
right.
what I mean by that is, you know, there's when you're talking about assisted living,
mm-hmm.
There's really no provision in the law to allow for coverage there in some way, some help. Now, although assisted living is normally $3,500, $4,000, $4,500 per month, there is a program called Special Assistance in North Carolina that's pretty limited, but it's capped off based on your income.
Mm-hmm.
And if your income is over a certain amount, you're not eligible for that at all. So a lot of people find themselves between the two.
Right. Right.
Both medically and financially.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's conceivable, and we see this quite often, where our clients, you know, the patient, their income is too high to receive any special assistance at all,
mm-hmm.
but they're still being billed $4,000 or $5,000 a month at assisted living facility.
Mm-hmm.
So they're having to find that money, you know, from somewhere, even if they don't have it. I mean, that is then requiring the children to then, or some family member to then, you know, dip into their own pocket to cover that.
So what you're saying is that, again, somebody may be well enough, but but not, in other words, not sick enough to have skilled care.
That's exactly
but
right.
Certainly poor enough to qualify otherwise.
That's exactly right. So at any rate, I think it's very important for folks to sit down, you know, with an attorney who deals with these mm-hmm. issues, someone who's going to kind of lay out the framework. And I think that also what's very important is what Cecil just indicated. I mean, many times, you know, our clients are squarely in that assisted living
right.
situation.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, maybe they have been diagnosed with dementia. Maybe there's an Alzheimer's mm-hmm. diagnosis. One of these, you know, diseases that we know, unfortunately, is progressive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know there are medications out there that try to slow that down.
Well, that was my mom's case.
Right.
She was in assisted living when she could still drive and had mm-hmm. a car in assisted
exactly.
living when we mm-hmm. got there. But as time went on,
right.
Dementia crept in. And,
right, right.
And
so, you know, sitting down with someone, an attorney who is skilled in this area, even at the stage where we don't quite need the skilled nursing yet,
mm-hmm.
but there is this diagnosis of dementia or Alzheimer's, a progressive disease, then obviously, we can plan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can plan for that possibility that this is going to progress to the point where we're going to need a higher level of care. And, you know, the power here for the client is just the knowledge, to mm-hmm. know what you can do.
Right, right.
I mean, sit across the table from someone who understands the complicated Medicaid laws. Let them explain to you how they're going to apply to your situation. If this happens, this happens, this happens. And then you make a decision about how you want to proceed. But in my opinion, the worst thing that you could do is to do nothing and not plan.
Mm.
Those are the situations where we're sometimes trying to play cleanup later on because there was a failure to plan.
Sure. Yeah, you put on the fireman's hat and try to put out the fire.
Right, though. Right.
All right. 7:43 in the morning, if you would like to call in with your questions about your legal life, you can do so. And then call us at 800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674. Hey, welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240, with our friends from Harvell & Collins, Attorneys at Law, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, talking about elder law issues.
Another thing, Ben, that we ought to touch on is these issues. Documentation is so very important.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, let's face it, a lot of times the primary caregiver becomes a child.
Mm-hmm.
A grandchild, a niece or nephew, someone in the family. And if this caregiver is being paid, then that needs to be reduced to a contract of employment. It needs to be fair, and it needs to be reasonable on all four corners, just like it would be if we are hiring for our loved one a professional caregiving service, of which there are several here in Eastern, I mean, as we know, here in Eastern North Carolina. They come out, they help us, they charge an hourly rate.
Here
comes the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can't name any specific names, but I think our listeners know what I'm talking about.
Sure.
I'm talking about a professional home care service provider.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if these services, rather than being provided by a commercial company, are being provided by a family member, then that agreement, that situation needs to be reduced to writing, needs to be documented. Okay, there needs to be a personal services contract. Another area of documentation is what Wes was referring to. Let's say that we do have one child that is paying for the over and beyond the what the Social Security happens to be, what the pension happens to be that's coming into the household, and it's still just not meeting the obligation at the assisted living facility.
Right.
Or even at the nursing home, as far as that's concerned, if this person has not qualified for Medicaid. And there's one child that, due to their financial circumstances, they are able to give $3,000 every month to make it all square.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that needs to be documented. Is that a gift or is that, you know, a loan? How is that going to eventually be dealt with when our loved one is no longer with us?
Right. There'll be a tax consequence, too.
There's a tax consequence if it is a gift. If it exceeds the annual exclusion, yes, there is. And, of course, if it's a loan between interested parties, believe it or not, the IRS, of course, dictates that there be, you know, the applicable federal rate. So, yes, as we begin to see, there are just issues here that a lawyer is going to recognize and help lead you through. I have a file in my office right now. It's a bit off subject from this, but it is an elder client who has given their nephew $175,000 to build a house on his lot, which does happen to be right next to the elder aunt who has no children. And, of course, the elder aunt is saying, you know, gosh, I want my nephew to live right next to me.
Right.
I'm getting older and older by the day.
Yeah.
By the way, so am I, Ben.
It all works
okay?
that way.
Okay. And the bottom line is that I want my nephew's house to be right next to me. And it's worth $175,000 to me to have him there. Well, you know, the nephew comes in to see me and just simply says that this is all just verbal, that this is just the way it is. And what happens if my aunt dies? You know, there are other heirs out there. I have other, she has other nieces and nephews.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to say that this $175,000 is a loan, okay, and I need to pay it back. Or is it a gift from my aunt? You know, so obviously the way that I analyzed that was to have the aunt include what she intends us to be in her will, because that gets us beyond the tax consequences. See, if it's a gift, there's a tax consequence. If it's a loan, then that needs to be documented. But if she just simply will put in her will that as to this, she intends this to be not repaid, and that this is part of his inheritance, and that is well documented and well drafted in her will, then this will take care of the issue. So the nephew went back and spoke to his aunt, and the aunt is talking to her lawyer about amending and modifying her will to do this, and I hope that that will happen. But again, documentation is what I'm talking about here.
Right, and planning ahead.
Documentation and planning ahead, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, been a couple other issues to add to what Cecil was saying regarding the personal services contract and then the loans. I mean, the reason you do that is because if you're providing care, let's say under the personal services contract, then you're entitled to compensation for that care. It has to be reasonable and customary amounts, just like, as Cecil indicated, would be paid through, you know, a normal caregiving service. Can't be an excessive amount. But if you don't have a personal services contract, any amount that is paid to a family member is deemed to be gratuitous, and it's not an allowed spend down. So what we're doing is we're slowly moving the estate, the assets, to the caregiver, but you need to document that with the personal services contract. So that's, you know, where we are with regard to that.
And then assets need to transfer.
Yeah,
right?
They're actually, the person's actually being paid.
Right.
But if the person is being paid and there's not a personal services contract, then DSS would see that as a gift if this is a family member, and it would be a sanctionable gift. So, again, documentation. You get the proper personal services contract in place, then the law allows that to be seen as compensation for a service provided, which is not sanctionable at all. So that pretty simple document contract is very important.
That's, right.
You know, first thing. And then the loan issue. You know, we don't see it quite as often, but sometimes you do have, like Cecil indicated, you know, the family member that can contribute a little bit every month, does contribute a little bit every month to make ends meet with regard to long-term care or whatever the circumstance might be. It might be assisted living, like we were talking about earlier. And again, you know, if we document that with the proper documentation, whether it be a contract or a promissory note showing that it is in fact a loan, and then the individual does have to go into nursing home care at some point in time, well, then we've got a loan that we have to pay back to this child who's been paying $2,000-$3,000 a month. That is an allowable spend down as well. It is not a gift. It is a loan, so it has to be paid off, and that could add up to be a good amount.
Okay. All right. We'll have more to come in a moment here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240, with Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. We're just talking about elder care and the personal services contract right there, too. And, Ken, you brought up a good question there.
Does that apply to a husband taking care of a wife or vice versa?
Absolutely. I mean, the way the law...
I probably ought to be under contract right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, the way the law works with regard to that is that, you know, services provided to a family member without an agreement are deemed to be gratuitous. So they're deemed to be without compensation. They're deemed to be for love, for affection, for you're my husband, you're my wife, I'm going to take care of you. You know, however, parties are free to contract as to, you know, anything that is not in breach of public policy, you know, to contract for, and even family members can do that. So yes, Ken, great question, but yes, a contract between husband and wife as it relates to compensation for this purpose would be recognized, and it would allow a transfer of asset without a sanction.
However, if it just built up on a tab, you know.
That's correct. However, that really, the answer to the question is that yes, that's allowable,
but
it doesn't help, because we can transfer assets from husband to wife and wife to husband all we want to in a Medicaid context. Medicaid counts all the assets of husband and wife. So even if the husband is the one going into the nursing home facility, all the assets held in the wife's name are counted as well. So transferring for care doesn't help us.
This program then ought to be called Tidbits About Elder Care.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a big one right
there. Yeah.
Let's talk about that in our last minute here. Medicaid does not honor a prenuptial agreement. So we have clients who come to see us on a regular basis in their 70s, 80s, and they've lost their spouse. They have wonderful kids from their first marriage, and they've now decided to get married. And they ask the question, you know, what is going to happen here? You know, 75, 80 years old. I have, you know, a large IRA. My loved one here, my wife-to-be, does not have a large IRA. She lives on Social Security. She has a home place. Are my assets going to be subject to her care?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is absolutely yes.
Mm.
Absolutely yes. And notwithstanding a prenuptial agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That keeps her from having
that
access.
That keeps her from having access to her assets for purposes of lots of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Divorce, inheritance, all the other reasons. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Medicaid does not honor that prenuptial agreement. So, or the terms of the prenuptial. You know, many times documents that we lawyers prepare, it's who it speaks to. You know, we talk about this a lot on the program. You know, a prenuptial, if it speaks to the divorce court, it's honored. If it speaks to the probate court, it's honored. If it speaks to the taxing authorities, it many times is honored. But if when it speaks to the Medicaid regulations, it is not honored.
How about assets placed in a trust? Does that matter?
Well, we've talked a lot about that over the last week or so, about the trust and how the assets can be in a trust if, in fact, they are real estate assets.
Right.
But to put liquidity into a trust is difficult and is kind of a program in and of itself, but is not a typical planning mechanism that we use, because the point is that liquidity in a trust, if you have access to it,
right.
Then Medicaid, of course, is going to then include it because you actually have access to it. This is the case with annuities, IRAs, 401k. From Medicaid's perspective, you have access to those funds, and so therefore they are included.
All right. And once again, that's getting into the weeds a little bit with that, but it's something that we definitely want to pay attention to there too. Well, as you heard, the folks at the Harvell and Collins will help you get that right advice at the right time, and that pre-planning is something that's always important, so you can call on them for more information at 252-726-9050. Set up that first appointment where you can look over everything before you decide about engaging their services there too. 252-726-9050, 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City, and online at harvellandcollins.com.